If the committee would please come to order.
Yeah. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. First bill on the agenda today is House File 215, Representative Rukavina. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. It's a pleasure to be here. This is just a bill I've been trying to pass for a few years, members. What it says is, you know, on your no-fault insurance, if you have losses that the insurance company has to pay you, it's no-fault insurance, and then if they contest it, they got to take you to an arbitration or a court, or that's what I'm hoping to do here, rather than you having to take them, the injured person that's been paying the insurance, and that's basically what it does, and I appreciate your support.
With that, the chair moves House File 215 to be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. Do you have any testifiers beyond yourself, Representative Rukavina?
No, I'm just here by myself.
All right. I have on the list of Mr. Peter Thrain from Leonard Street and Diner.
I'm sure he's supporting this.
I would imagine. Good morning.
You know that insurance companies always like to pay what they're obliged to pay, and they don't like to sit on people's money and make interest off it, but I'm sure I'm going to hear that somewhere.
Thank you, Representative Rukavina. Mr. Thrain, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the tape and proceed.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Peter Thrain. I represent the State Farm Mutual Insurance Companies. And just wanted to point out to you why we think this bill is bad for Minnesota consumers. You know, as drafted, this bill substantially changes the arbitration system for no-fault in Minnesota. It's just basically, if there's a dispute, as Representative Rukavina indicated, for no-fault benefits in Minnesota, it goes to an arbitration proceeding. And that proceeding is not without cost. It takes, you know, 4 to 6 months. It typically costs the insurer or the plaintiff $3,500, $2,500, $4,000 to handle this. And what Representative Rukavina's bill would do is essentially say that in order for an insurance company to deny any claim for no-fault benefits, it would require a decision of an arbitrator to do that. So, you know, consider some of the factual scenarios. You know, if I'm painting my garage and I slip on my off the ladder and I twist my knee and I make a claim, my insurance company now, in order to deny that claim as not being compensable as a no-fault benefit, would have to bring an arbitration proceeding. And it would have to run up costs considering $3,500, $2,500 to deny each and every claim. The other part about considering this kind of an issue is that an awful lot of these claims are reimbursement for medical expenses. And as you know, in Minnesota, for personal injury protection, there's very limited cost containment right now. The insurance company is required to reimburse all reasonable medical expenses. There's no managed care. There are no fee schedules. And so if it costs $2,500, $3,000 to litigate the denial of any claim, is it cost-effective to spend that kind of money to litigate $250, $300, $500, $600 claims? At some point, the insurance company is incented not to resist those kinds of claims, and those that are submitting the bills are going to start to understand that. The effect of this is simply rolled onto the costs of insurance and the premiums that consumers pay. This is hard to speculate as to what this does because we're not aware of it, this system existing anywhere in the country or in any kind of a work comp context. So it's hard to speculate what it would do. But we believe it would probably increase over time premiums somewhat and probably somewhat significantly. And for that reason, we would suggest that it's not good for consumers in Minnesota, and we'd ask you to oppose this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Rukavina, any response?
Well, you know, I'm glad to hear the representative from the insurance company talk about insurance companies being required to reimburse when you make a claim because the experience I've had both as a consumer and as a legislator in getting contacted by folks is that basically they never want to pay. Or, you know, you have windshield replacement on your auto insurance and you break the windshield and they cancel you because you broke the windshield and you put in a claim on something you thought you had. I've had consumers over the years that have had floods and fires that have had to hire attorneys to get that. But I specifically Maybe I'm a little confused on this because I thought I was dealing with no-fault auto insurance and not workers' comp and slipping in your garage. So this, I thought, just dealt, and maybe Mr. Pender can correct me if I'm wrong, but I thought it dealt with no-fault auto insurance and the fact that when you have medical and the wage loss bills piling up and your insurance company is refusing to pay them, that all I'm saying is they pay you up front and then they take you to the arbitration court and try to get the money back, if that's what they're saying, rather than you having to hire an attorney and you taking them. So, members, I would hope that you would help the little person against the insurance companies, and I'd appreciate your support.
Mr. Pender.
Mr. Chair and members, Representative Rukavina is right in saying that it covers only auto claims and not workers' comp claims.
Any questions for Representative Rukavina? Seeing none, the chair renews his motion that House File 215 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails.
Thank you, members.
Members, while we were here, let's review the minutes of our March 5th meeting. Is there someone who wishes to move the minutes? Thank you, Representative Szymanski. All those in favor say aye.
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 Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairman Dabney. I will be presiding over the rest of this meeting today. And before we get started, I want to remind you all that being a freshman member of the legislature, I do have a few years on my odometer. And I spent 35 years in the classroom. And I always started the class on time, and I ended on time, and we achieved our objectives. So my objective today is to make sure that we complete our work on time. So the first thing I might mention is that we will probably have to reduce a little of the time for testimony because we started late. And with that in mind, welcome, Representative Dabney. It'll be a great pleasure for me to ask you put your name on the record.
All right. Thank you, Chair Benson. Representative Jim Dabney. We're going to do a broad presentation of issues around predatory lending initially, and then allow testimony on both sides of the issue and on both sides of the bills that are before the committee today, and then work through the individual bills. Members and guests, the financial service market today is very different than it was even a few years ago. Relaxed underwriting standards, the impact of the Internet, and other dynamics have allowed a wide variety of new mortgage products and expanded access to credit for many borrowers. Subprime lending has provided opportunities to many previously shut out of the opportunity for home ownership. But with these positive developments have come an ugly downside of predatory lending by some members of the industry. They target primarily communities of color and low-income communities for high fees, escalating interest rates, unfavorable loan terms, repeated refinancings, and other abusive practices. These loans are disproportionately involved in the rising tide of foreclosures. Between 2005 and 2006, Hennepin County saw an increase of 81% in its foreclosure rate. Ramsey County, a 125% increase. Scott County, a 122% increase in foreclosures. Lest we think this is a metropolitan phenomenon, it is not. In that same 2005 to 2006 time period, Stearns County saw a 62% increase, Blue Earth County a 56% increase, and so on. These foreclosures are emotionally devastating and disruptive to the families involved and destabilize the surrounding community. And more are to come. A dramatic number of adjustable rate mortgages across the country are scheduled to unlock and begin adjusting upwards in just May and June of this year, in the same timeline that we adjourn as a legislature. It's against this backdrop that the bills you will hear today have been researched and written. Our responsibility as legislators is to balance the need for a healthy, dynamic mortgage market and the need to assure consumers that they will be treated fairly and ethically when they apply for a loan.
Welcome, Representative Clark, another chairman of one of my committees, and I will also enjoy asking you to put your name on the record.
Thank you, Chair Benson. I'm Representative Karen Clark, and I represent, and I have the honor to represent, three inner-city neighborhoods in South Minneapolis. And I have to say that the issue of predatory lending that you're talking about today is one of the most urgent economic justice issues we have on our plate, I would say, this year at the legislature. We're talking about people who believe that they're going to have part of the American dream, to own their own home and be able to take care of it. And the kind of practices that you're going to hear about today and that we are trying to correct with these bills, they need to be curtailed. I've been working on this issue for at least a decade. And I want to thank some of the folks who are here today who have been working on it a long time, too. And I have to say, this summer I was invited to the garage of one of my friends. And when I got there, there were about 60 people there. And they were very concerned about what was happening to them in terms of some of the issues of what I would call preying on people, definitely, predatory lending. Also some issues that dealt with fraud in terms of some of the retail practices. What we're dealing with here today, I think, is a very, very important first step. And we have tried to pass laws that would help educate people, understand what's going on in recent years. Now we need to do some things that deal with that provide very strong regulation. So I want to thank Representative Dabney. He's really taken a run with this. The Attorney General's Office study group was very important, and my bill was based on that. And basically, my bill is all inside of Dabney's bill, so and the Mullery bill. So the three of us have really come together on this, and I'm grateful for Representative Dabney's leadership going forward. I also want to thank Legal Services and Minnesota Acorn organizations who've done a lot of work on the ground with this.
Thank you, Representative Clark. Welcome, Attorney General Swanson.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to be here. I'm here this morning testifying as Attorney General for Minnesota, but this is an issue of predatory lending that I've cared about and been involved about for a long time. Before becoming Attorney General, I was Solicitor General and Deputy Attorney General and in charge of supervising the state's enforcement actions as it relates to predatory mortgage lending. In addition to that, last year I was chair of the Consumer Advisory Council of the Federal Reserve Board of Governors out in Washington, D.C., was vice chair in 2005 and was a member of the council in 2004, put on by Alan Greenspan. And one of the biggest things we dealt with and talked about there was the issue of foreclosures and predatory mortgage lending. So I want to thank you, Mr. Chairman, you members of the committee, and the representatives for their interest and attention to what I think is a very, very important issue. A mortgage transaction is the most complicated transaction by far that any individual citizen will ever enter into. In addition to that, it's also the most expensive transaction that any individual will enter into. The home is the way that most Americans in our society have built their nest egg for retirement and have built the savings. All of this, though, can lead to a situation that can be ripe for fraud and unfair advantage because it is such a complicated transaction. The Attorney General's Office in Minnesota was the lead state in the country's two biggest predatory mortgage lending cases and settlements, one involving a company called AmeriQuest, one involving a company called Household Finance. And through those enforcement actions, as well as other actions and complaints that the Attorney General's Office receives, I can tell you that predatory mortgage lending is a very real and large problem facing our state and facing our entire state, the suburbs, the cities, as well as greater Minnesota. The kinds of issues we've seen are problems where state of income or low documentation loans are made based on no verification of the borrower's ability to repay. Simply mortgage lenders writing or offering a mortgage loan based on what the consumer states to be their income without even retrospectively looking backwards to look at their tax return and find out whether they have that income. Why is that important? Well, in some cases, it allows brokers to literally make up income that people never had, jobs they never had, income they never had, pretending that they generate $2,000 a month by having an apartment in the basement of their home that they don't really have. Other problems that we've seen are problems with churning of loans, refinancing of loans, not because there's any validity to the refinancing, but simply refinancing of loans to churn a commission on the part of the broker. And we've seen big problems with adjustable rate mortgages in terms of low teaser rates, low initial teaser rates that explode, and people find sticker shock where they can't make their payments. And also big problems with things like inflated property appraisals. In my opinion, this activity has resulted from deregulation, lack of regulation, and certain intricacies of the market itself, where loans are quickly underwritten by a lender, but then sold off on the secondary market and pooled on Wall Street, so that the person who issues a loan isn't ultimately the person holding the bag when the borrower goes into default. We've been fortunate in Minnesota to be a state with high levels of home ownership, which is a good thing for our citizens and a good thing for our economy. But in December, we were also the sixth fastest growing state when it comes to mortgage foreclosures. Why there are people who are issued a loan who are issued that loan through fraud and deception, or issued a loan based on a lack of underwriting where they don't have the ability to pay it back, they get in trouble. The U.S. Commerce Department reported last month that we as a country have a negative savings rate. It's a negative savings rate of 1%, lowest since 1933 in the Great Depression, which means there are those among us who are working hard yet living paycheck to paycheck and have no cushion and are susceptible to surprises in their mortgage transaction when they don't know about things like taxes and insurance or that their prices will be reset after they explode. And in the last few weeks, just in this country, we've seen one mortgage lender oust two of its top executives after surprising investors by telling Wall Street that its reserves for bad loans was going to be $10.5 billion. $10.5 billion one company reserves for bad loans. Another lender after lender has reported record high levels of foreclosure, the highest since 2002. Federal prosecutors and securities regulators are looking at one of the country's biggest lenders and investigating them for how they reported bad loans that were bought back after being sold. And at least 20 subprime lenders are in bankruptcy or being sold off or facing financial turmoil. So it's a very, very real problem. What are the consequences of predatory lending? Many. It's bad for the families involved, bad for the homeowners involved. They can lose their home to foreclosure. They can be underwater through faulty appraisals, meaning they're stuck in their home or can't sell their home. It's bad for the communities involved, bad for the neighborhoods involved, because it creates devaluation, destability of the home. And it's bad for our economy, bad for the market, bad for investors. By some estimates, housing is 20% of our economy, housing and real estate. So it's a big chunk of our economy. And when you see this kind of turmoil with these types of foreclosures, it can result in great stability. And as I mentioned, the way lenders sell these loans off quickly and don't hold them in their portfolio, there's a mutually dependent web of businesses out there that is being destabilized because these loans are going into default. This is a problem that I appreciate the committee's attention to. It's a problem that is getting a great deal of attention in other states at the national level as well. We see Freddie Mac, which is a government enterprise that buys mortgages buys bonds backed by subprime loans, has now announced that it's only going to buy loans where the borrower qualifies for the higher payments that are going to result in after repricing, so that people don't have this kind of sticker shock. Freddie Mac saying we ought to look at taxes and insurance and what is a full obligation of borrower's ability to repay. Last week, the federal banking regulators issued some guidelines expressing concerns about things like prepayment penalties, issuing loans without verifying the ability of the applicants to pay them. In 2007, there are going to be, by many estimates, about $250 billion in subprime loans repriced yet again this spring. So it's an issue that is not going away. Many among us in our communities are going to see that repricing here this spring. And unfortunately, I think we'll see yet additional foreclosures resulting from it. So I just want to thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, members of the committee. Thank Representative Clark, Representative Dabney, for the attention that you're bringing to this important issue.
Thank you, Madam Attorney General. And by the way, committee members, you may have noticed I didn't ask the Attorney General to state her name for the record. Her job is above my grade. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members.
Thank you. Do we have Professor Cox and Amber Hawkins here? They would step forward. Professor Cox, welcome to the committee, and if you'd state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Prentice Cox, PRENTISS, COX. I appreciate you having me here, Representative Clark, Representative Dabney. Also appreciate you asking me to testify. And I want to recognize some people, all the people from Acorn here, and just note that there's a bunch of people over there I remember from about 1999 who are still here. And they've been doing it without any pay. And they really need some recognition for the tremendous work they've done on this. Well, Jordan's got some pay, but not as much as he should. I'm going to try to be very brief and go over the bill. Really quickly, I want to add some things about the nature of the problem, but I think that's been fairly adequately covered. I'd like to do a brief overview of the bill, and then I will run through the provisions of the bill. In terms of the nature of the problem, I want to focus your attention to the nearest chart on my left, your right over here, and it pretty much says it all. There is a wave of foreclosures that has hit this state. This is Hennepin County. For the last 20 years, the number of foreclosures in Hennepin County rode a fairly steady stream of 30% roughly up and down from about 1,100 a year. In 1995, we slightly broke that barrier, and in 1996, we went up to 3,000. It basically tripled in a two-year period. The impact of this happens on three different levels. One is it's devastating to people's individual lives. And I have also done a lot of work over the last few years. Thank you all for the previous legislature in passing the 325N bill, which has served as a model throughout the country for dealing with foreclosure rescue scams. It's been passed now in four other states, and there's at least six other states that have model legislation based on Minnesota's to deal with that problem. But the individual tragedy is really can't be overstated. I have more than once met with people who were in foreclosure. We were attempting to deal with them who have dealt with these scammers. And one of the spouses came back a few months later, and the spouse had either died of stress or suicide. So the consequences for individuals are devastating. There's also consequences for the neighborhoods. When you get a concentration of foreclosures, it creates a downward cycle of empty buildings and despair in the neighborhoods, the nature of the housing market, and the stability of the neighborhood. And we've begun to see that in certain concentrated areas of Minneapolis. And I'm afraid, I have concern that that problem is going to spread throughout many other neighborhoods. The third level is something where 2 years ago I would say this and everyone would treat me like Cassandra. And I will admit to having Cassandra-type tendencies. But on this one, I can only say I told you so. The consequences of these foreclosures have threatened the stability of the global financial world. And if you pick up the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times, that almost any day over the last month, last week, every single day, the New York Times had a top the business section or front page article about the serious concerns throughout the financial market about the level of debt we've got in our society based on mortgage financing. And this is something that should be a great concern. You have primary responsibilities in some ways, equal responsibilities with the federal government for dealing with this, because this is regulated at both the state and federal level. And many of these originated loans, the majority of them, are in fact state-regulated loans, not federally regulated. Now, having said that, why is there such a concern about the financial markets and how did we get here? One more point. Take a look at the graph on my right, your left. 10 years ago, subprime lending was what it should be, a very rare instrument used in extraordinary circumstances to give people loans that they needed. That changed. Now, almost 40% of our lending market is either subprime, which is about 22%, or what's called Alt A, which is these risky option arm products and negative amortization products where your mortgage payment will never pay off there's options to never pay off your loan, and that actually you get negative equity created. And when you've got a situation where you've got 1 or 2% of the market in subprime and you've got problems in the subprime industry, it's bad, and it's tragic for certain individuals, but it doesn't reach the level we've got now. This is unprecedented. We've done something different in the last 10 years with subprime. We've done something different in the last 3 years when the Alt-A products went from 2 or 3% of the market to 15%. Those are those risky complicated Oxnard product. When you put those two parts of the market together, we've got an unprecedented amount of risk in our mortgage lending. Now I'm going to do an overview quickly of the legislation. The point of the legislation was to attempt to address it, what we can at the state level, these sorts of problems. The first thing I hope that you'll notice about the legislation is that a lot of it looks real common-sensey, because that's what it is. Some of these provisions, you might read them and go, why do we need a provision to do that? Don't we have borrowers verify their income? Can you actually just get a loan by coming in and say, give me a mortgage loan at a higher rate and I won't tell you anything about my income and assets? And the answer is, not only do we have that, that used to be a very rare exotic product, but it's become extremely common. And so a lot of what the bill does is just bring us back to common sense, prudence, and fairness in lending. The second thing is the bill restores some prior mortgage lending standards that used to exist in Minnesota law and were written out over the last 10 years or so. The third thing it does is apply substantially similar standards that have recently been promulgated by federal regulators in response to this foreclosure crisis and decrease in credit quality to state loans that otherwise they would not apply to. And finally, we've developed new standards to remedy the most common deceptive practices or the most egregious deceptive practices. Now, if you'd like, Mr. Chair, I'll go through very briefly, if I can, the substantive provisions of the bill.
Please do.
There are two bills before you that I will talk about. One is the Dabney bill, one is the Mullery bill. Representative Clark's bill is overlapped in these two bills. The Dabney bill, I will break into four different pieces. The first piece I'll talk to you about is what I call the prudent lending standards. And this is an attempt to just bring back some common sense prudence to our lending requirements. The first item, which is 58.13 subdivision 1, and then it's the 23, it's that long list of standards, adds to that list of standards for mortgage lending, number 23, which is simply says that the borrower has to have the reasonable ability to pay and that the reasonable ability to pay has to be verified. I really have a hard time imagining why this would create controversy, but that's the first standard. The second one is about what we call churning. You could also call flipping, but we had a flipping scandal about 7 or 8 years ago in North Minneapolis, and this isn't the same as that. So this is, we'll call it churning. And the goal of the general standard in churning is that the loan must benefit the borrower. You can't make a loan to somebody. It's just like securities churning. You can't make a loan, you can't sell somebody stock and then sell them more stock 6 months later and sell that and buy more stock 6 months later for the purpose of creating broker commissions. And all we're doing is essentially applying that same churning standard to mortgages. And the general standard is when you give somebody a mortgage, it has to have a benefit to the borrower. We've also put in a rebuttable presumption of what is churning that has two basic elements, which is if you're going to refinance someone's loan within 2 years, it's presumptively churning if you refinance them and give them a higher interest rate within 2 years of their last refinance, with the exception that if they're in foreclosure, that doesn't apply. That's not a prohibition, but it is a rebuttable presumption that that constitutes churning. The third element of the prudent lending standards is prohibit loans that over a six-month period result in negative amortization, where you actually are going backwards in terms of the equity in your home. The second area of the Dabney bill is a particular deceptive sales practice that's been around as long as I've been doing this work. This is just one that doesn't seem to die, which is that borrowers are quoted a loan amount, a monthly payment amount, based on principal and interest rather than the full principal, interest, taxes, and insurance. So this provision simply says if you're quoting someone a loan amount and they currently have, and it's a refinance, and they currently have a principal, interest, taxes, and insurance payment, you have to give them an apples-to-apples quote on what their monthly payment is so they don't get the closing or worse yet beyond and figure out that they actually have just refinanced their loan and it doesn't include their taxes and insurance. And again, this is a practice that has just happened repeatedly that just won't seem to die. The third area is the preventing the evasion of the 5% fee limit in law. In 2002, this legislature passed an excellent cap on the amount of fees that could be financed in a mortgage loan. Essentially said, if you're financing the fees in the mortgage loan, the limit is 5%. However, when that was passed, there were two omissions from that, which has made it easy to evade. The first one is what's called yield spread premiums. Now, I've become a professor now, although as those of you who know me before that probably look at me and think, you know, like the Scarecrow in Wizard of Oz, you know, gave me a little medal and I'm a professor, right? But, you know, so I'd ask if I was in class how many people know what yield spread premiums are, but I'll tell you what it is real briefly. Basically, if a mortgage broker sells you a loan at a higher interest rate than you qualify for, the mortgage broker gets a payment for selling you a worse loan directly from the lender. Now, the justification for this, the only justification for this, is that the mortgage broker is giving you a higher interest rate, but presumably you're getting lower costs on your loan. So you're trading off interest rate for cost. Well, if that's the case, there's absolutely no reason to not, and that's the only justification, there's no reason not to put those yield spread premium payments into the 5% cost cap, because it's a trade-off for cost. And that's been an easy way to evade this, is you go up to the 5% on the cost, but then you also do this backdoor that often, typically, the consumer doesn't even know about, unless they hawkeye their HUD-1 settlement and know exactly what they're looking for. The other provision that's included in the 5% is just throwing back in the lending costs, which are typically these days through affiliates of mortgage companies. So the holding company of the mortgage company winds up getting the money off in any way. The fourth area of the Dabney bill is preventing use of a form waiver of fiduciary duty for mortgage brokers. Currently, Minnesota law requires that these brokers be fiduciaries, which means that they have to act in the best interest of the client. The mortgage broker is telling you, I'm going to shop around and get you the best deal on a mortgage. And the law simply requires that they be fiduciaries when they do that, which is to say, they act in your best interest in that process. But then the law takes it all away by saying, yeah, but you can give a form waiver to the consumer and you're no longer a fiduciary. And I don't know how many people here actually read all their mortgage documents. I do that, and they scream at me. They say, we have a reader, and they put you in a separate room, and they make a big deal, and they pressure you, and it's like, this is outrageous. You can't read these documents, you know? So the truth is people just are overwhelmed with paper in the mortgage process, and the form waiver allows them to get out of the fiduciary duty without people understanding what's happening. Now I'll briefly summarize the four provisions of the Mullery Bill. The first provision is the prohibition on refinancing of special mortgages. An example of this is Habitat for Humanity loans or other, it's limited to government and nonprofit loans that have certain conditions such as voidability of the payments or no principal and interest payments or payments less than 2% interest. If you meet one of these special mortgage loan criteria, very narrow, this says before you can refinance one of those loans, you have to get credit counseling. It's really that simple. The problem underlying this is people have these Habitat loans. They're often vulnerable consumers, and they get convinced to refinance these loans that are clearly not in their interest. The second part of the Mullery bill is to restore the ban on prepayment penalties that existed in Minnesota law prior to 1997 or 96. And it would simply take out the existing provisions that allow for those and put back in this Minnesota law's state as of about 10 years ago and prohibit those prepayment penalties. The third provision is especially important because it creates a better civil enforcement mechanism for those who have been victims of mortgage lending fraud. Under the existing law, there's sort of a bootstrap way to attempt to enforce some of these provisions in a private right of action through the private attorney general statute, but because of the Supreme Court decision in 2000, it's essentially almost, it can almost be said to be unavailable to consumers, to individuals to use that. For those of you who want more information on that, read a brilliant article published this last fall in the William Mitchell Law Review. The bill, the Mullery bill, would put in an express private right of action within Chapter 58 itself that includes also the right to obtain punitive damages if the consumer can show there's a widespread practice that has affected others and other specific criteria that is, that are identified there. The Mullery bill also includes a creating a private right of action within Chapter 82B to address the poor, not just consumers there, but also lenders or anyone else, to address the problem of appraisers who knowingly inflate property values, which has been a serious problem over the last few years, or otherwise violate the standards for appraisers in Chapter 82B. Finally, the Mullery bill creates criminal liability for mortgage fraud. I do want to clarify this a little bit. If you read the bill, one thing that people sometimes say, and I understand how they get there, the bill defines grossly unsuitable loans in a certain way. And then it says there's a criminal liability for knowingly providing someone a grossly unsuitable loan. Now, a grossly unsuitable loan means two things, essentially. The borrower lacks the capacity to repay the loan. An example would be, and literally this is a real example, a woman's on Social Security and supplemental disability payments and gets $980 a month, and the loan is $940 a month. And there's other fraudulent income in there, perhaps. But if you lack the ability to pay the loan and you knowingly provide someone a loan where you lack the ability to pay, it's criminal. The other criminal provision for grossly unsuitable would be if you if the mortgage originator knowingly provides a loan application that contains materially false or fraudulent income information as to the borrower's income, expenses, debts, or assets. The misconception here is that if the loan officer provides an application that contains this information, they're not criminally liable if they didn't know it contained false information. So the knowing is written in. These definitions have to be incorporated in Subdivision 2, which is to say you're only creating criminal liability for mortgage originators who knowingly do one of these two acts. Those are essentially the provisions of the bill. Sorry to gallop through it, but I know you're on limited time.
Thank you, Professor Cox. That was terrific and lots of information there. And before we go to Ms. Hawkins, I want to welcome Representative Mullery, and I run a tight ship, so you have 30 seconds if you'd like to say something.
Mr. Chair, in 30 seconds, I probably can't expand too much beyond what Mr. Cox has done. He did almost as good an explanation of this area of law as I would have.
That's very humble of you. Thank you for your comments.
Actually, Mr. Chair, there were a couple of the provisions that were my ideas. So.
I'm sure they were. Ms. Hawkins, welcome to the committee, and if you state your name for the record, please, and then proceed with your testimony.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Amber Hawkins. I'm with the Legal Services Advocacy Project. I'm actually just here to make sure that Mr. Cox doesn't miss anything, but for those of you who know him, he rarely misses anything. So I really don't have much to say other than Legal Aid has been involved in the issue of predatory lending for a long time. I have personally litigated many of these cases on behalf of Legal Aid clients. My clients have ranged from white senior citizens in the suburbs and in the inner city to people of color in the suburbs and in the inner city. I mean, and it's happening everywhere, and these problems really need to be addressed. And on behalf of Legal Aid and our clients, we just want to thank our authors for taking the leadership role on this issue and really setting out to do something about the problem this year. I also want to thank some of the members of the industry. We have been meeting with some of the mortgage bankers and the brokers, and we are trying diligently to address some of their concerns with the bill so that we can have, with both of these bills, so that we can have a product that everyone feels is going to combat the true issues that are out there. I think we all agree that the problem needs to be addressed. We may disagree about certain aspects of the problem or the way to do it, but we are working together, and I think we've got some good potential to get a great bill this year. I just want to thank you all.
Thank you, Ms. Hawkins. Okay, we're now going to take some testimony, a public testimony on the bill, and because of the time factor, I'm going to allow 20 minutes for comments in favor of legislation and 20 minutes in opposition so we can have a little opportunity for questioning later. Yes?
Mr. Chairman, I do have a clarification question. Are we moving all three bills, or are we moving Daphne's bill? What's the process?
We're moving Daphne bill and the Mallory bill and the Clark bill, right? Clark, no, not just the first two.
My bill is basically subsumed in.
Yes, been subsumed into the other two.
Chairman, I do have a question that I'd like clarified by either Representative Daphne or... I noticed that Representative Daphne's is slightly different than the Clark and Mallory bill, unless I'm missing something. But on page 3... of the Mallory bill, it talks about special mortgages, written certification from a counselor, and I don't find that in Representative Daphne's bill, unless I'm missing something.
Representative, there are some differences in the bills. I think if we have an opportunity to hear discussion, and then we can have time for questions and can deal with those differences, if you don't mind, because of the pressure of time.
I was going to explain the answer, but if you want to hold on.
Why don't you hold on? Let's move on. So we have 20 minutes for each. And out of respect now for all the testifiers, would everyone be as quick as they can? I remember a quote from Samuel Johnson. He wrote a letter, an apologetic letter to a friend of his, saying, "I'm sorry I wrote you this long letter, but I didn't have time to write a short one." So I'm hoping all of those of you who are testifying are going to present a short letter today because you had the time to prepare. So I'm going to read off some names, and we'll put it in this order. Maybe we can have two people at a time come forward. So we'll start with Mr. Zemke, followed by Mr. Bennett, followed by Mr. Repplinger, followed by Ms. Davis, followed by Mr. Keevil, followed by Mr. Leto, and finally then Mr. Crump, and those will be the testifiers in favor of the bill. So welcome to the committee, and would you state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony?
I will. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee members. My name is, I will try to be brief and not be repetitive. My name is Scott Zemke. I'm Director of Operations at Community Action Partnership of Suburban Hennepin. Our agency serves the 45 suburban Hennepin County communities. We are a HUD-approved, full-cycle housing counseling agency offering pre- and post-purchase counseling and education, home rehab counseling, reverse mortgage counseling, and foreclosure prevention counseling. In addition, I am a foreclosure prevention specialist. I come before you in strong support of aggressive anti-predatory lending legislation. As many predicted, the failures of the subprime lending market have been exposed and sent shockwaves into the prime lending market and down Wall Street. Though I will not profess to you that subprime lending and alternative financing have no place in the market, I can say with certainty that they have been abused by enough people and institutions in the industry that thousands of individuals, families, and their communities have been and will be devastated by the ensuing foreclosures and abuse that that the abuse has made inevitable. As many of you know, foreclosures are pervasive in certain neighborhoods in Minneapolis and St. Paul, leaving 50% or more of homes on entire blocks boarded and or for sale, driving down property values and causing blight. While not as noticeable because of decreased density, this problem is also bleeding into the suburbs. Brooklyn Park, St. Louis Park, Brooklyn Center, Richfield, and other first-ring suburbs are seeing skyrocketing foreclosure rates as well as mortgage delinquencies. Community Action Partnership has seen a threefold increase in the number of phone calls we are receiving from clients facing foreclosure. While some of these calls come from people that have had an illness, lost their job, or gotten a divorce, the vast majority are from people that are in loans that should have never been written. They are loans that were written for more than the house was worth because of inflated appraisals. They are adjustable rate mortgages that a household may have been able to afford at the teaser rate, but clearly had no chance of affording once the rate reset. They are negative amortization and interest-only loans that were at best a gamble when the housing market was solid. I would like to share just a few of these stories with you. A single mother that does not work because she stays at home with her two disabled children and lives on Social Security disability was given a high interest rate mortgage with a monthly payment of $1,200. The monthly household income is $1,500. She has since lost the home that was left to her by her mother. A family of four that was new to this country wished to purchase a home. They did not have a down payment, so they used 80-20 financing to purchase a home that appraised at just under $500,000. The second mortgage is an ARM with a current interest rate of over 11%. Their total monthly mortgage payment is $3,700, 77% of their net monthly income of $4,800, leaving $1,100 for transportation, food, utilities, and all of their expenses for a household of four. A young single
Mr. Sumpty, I'm sorry to interrupt you, and I was always a kind teacher, but my students went on with their reports too long. I thought we're going to have to move forward, I'm afraid. Thank you very much for that testimony, though. Mr. Bennett, welcome to the committee. Could you give your name and proceed, please?
My name is Alton Lloyd Bennett. I am the National Board President of Acorn Housing Corporation, a sister organization to ACORN, the Association of Community Organizations for Reform Now. We have, at ACORN Housing, assisted over 1,500 members secure homes in the Twin Cities, over 50,000 nationally. Our goal at ACORN Housing is to provide affordable housing opportunities for ACORN members, communities, and neighborhoods. Why? Because it is the fastest way that we know of for low and moderate income people to build wealth. In the 80s, we got banks to change their lending practices to be more conducive to low and moderate income lending. Specifically, we got them to look at alternative forms of credit. They could look at someone's rent, phone bill, electric bill, all those things to determine whether or not a person was credit worthy. They could use all forms of income, Social Security, SSI. The banks would assist in down payment assistance, closing cost assistance. Why? Because these are the things that were true barriers in preventing low and moderate income people from becoming homeowners. The problem and the reason I'm here today is because after all that hard work, we're finding that our members are losing homes when they try to refinance through a predatory lender. Now, the reason that I wanted to be here today is that, as mentioned earlier, there are opportunities for the subprime market in our neighborhood. Many of the people that we deal with will probably need some form of subprime loan. That could be the vehicle which will help someone become a homeowner and better themselves. I've had many people ask, if you could just help me with my down payment, if you could help me with budgeting, if you could help me with this whole process that seems so foreign to me, I think I'll be all right. I have never, and I have had none of my counselors report to me, someone saying, if you just give me a predatory loan, I will be all right. There is a place for the subprime market in our neighborhoods. There is now and never will be a need for predatory loans. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Bennett. You were right on time. You made a great student of mine. I appreciate it very much. Mr. Repplinger, would you state your name for the record, please, and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Joseph Repplinger. My wife and I got married in 1970, and we have four kids and that are grown up, and I got nine grandkids. We bought a house in September of 1975 for $24,900. I have refinanced it, I'd say about 3-4 times. I don't remember when, but I think the first one was household finance, and then I refinanced again through AmeriQuest 2 years later. Now I owe $186,000 on it, and the way my mortgage is set up, another 2 years I'll owe $209,000. I was in roofing and construction for 35 years, and I had injuries one after another. And I did not have insurance to pay for it. That's why I refinanced my house the first time. Then in 2003, I worked on one person's house, and then I went down the steps, and on the bottom of the steps was ice on the concrete, and I slipped and fell and went backwards and hit my back of my head on the bottom concrete step. So I went after the homeowner's insurance company and took my attorney and me 3.5 years to get any results. In between then, I could not work. I couldn't get anything done, and I could not pay my bills. In order to pay my doctor bills, I had to refinance again. I was getting literature in the mail, so I called up this company, Pinewood Mortgage, and they said it was a 30-year fix, but it wasn't. It was only a 2-year ARM. And when I had the loan with America's payment before, it was $800, and then when I went through Pinewood, it went up to $1,100 a month. I don't think I got anything out of it. My payment went up, and all I got out was probably $2,500 in medical bills. We signed because we thought it was a good deal, and it ended up being a bad deal. That was in April of 2006. At that time, we told my credit was bad. They told me to refinance within 2 years. They said when my credit gets better, they will call me again. But I told them my credit was never bad. My credit score was 665. So in December, they called back and told me to refinance again, and they had come up with a better plan. Then they told me that I'd only have to pay $560-some a month. I said, well, that's a pretty good deal. So I didn't even question it. They said that they could get me a better loan, but it ended up being a worse loan. I found out that I had deferred payments, and I seen an advert on TV about reverse mortgage, so they came over and talked to me about it. The lady from reverse mortgage company looked at my papers. She told me that they had really robbed me. What I'm paying the first month only was $544, and I'm still owed $778, so the total of the first month's payment would be $1,319. After that, it was just kept going up. So I keep owing more and more on the house. You know, this is what they didn't tell me, and what would happen. I would not have taken it if I knew. I told the owner of Pinewood this, and he says, well, I've got kids to feed too. And I said, what's that got to do with it? Why should I feed your kids? The only thing I got from it was a check for $1,300-some, which I didn't ask for. You know, I found out also they falsified my papers, saying I made something like $4,500 a month, but I only get $13,000 a year from my disability Social Security. I wish I made that much, and that's how these guys must have passed it through. It's going to be hard to make the payments because the first 12 months is going to be $540, and then it's $580, and after 12 months, then after that it goes to $628 for the third year, and then the fourth year is just $1,500 a month. But I got to get something done way before that because it's not going to work. It just makes it hard because, you know, eventually we might get foreclosed on, and the kids... If something ever happened to us, Pete. They couldn't afford to keep it, I know. I would like to see these brokers shut down or have them redo my whole thing without no cost to me to bring it back down to where it's supposed to be, or else to have them pay back the closing costs that I paid in April of 6 and then December of 6. That's almost $20,000. That they got on me in 1 year.
That's okay, Mr. Ripplinger. We appreciate your testimony very much. Very moving. I think that's why we all ran for office, isn't it, ladies and gentlemen? Ms. Davis, welcome to the committee. If you state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony, please.
Thank you. My name is Clarissa Davis. I have to admit that I'm very embarrassed to be in front of a room full of people that I don't know and to admit to you how stupid I am. I'm over 60, and you would think that in 60 years' time that I would become wise and not a fool. But I want you to know what's happened to me. I live in the Frogtown area, and my home is over 100 years old. It has a lot of repairs that need to be done, but my house is all that I have. I am raising my grandson. I've had him since he was a month old. He's now 16, and he's an honors student. I feel that the Frogtown area is being targeted by these predatory lenders because they know that we are elderly people, they know that our homes are old, and they know that there are repairs that need to be made. What happened to me is my homeowner's insurance threw me out. They, when it was time for my insurance to be renewed, they came out to the house and they took pictures and they said, you have some structural damage. It has to be completed. Until it is, we are not going to renew you. So I had no homeowner's insurance for about 4 or 5 months. I get about 3 or 4 calls a night from these lenders. And it's like hanging a carrot in front of you. Do you have credit card bills that need to be paid? Do you have home repairs that need to be made? That was the carrot that was hung in front of me. Yes, I have home repairs that need to be made. I don't have any homeowner's insurance. If my house catches on fire, I'm going to lose everything that I own. So I went ahead and talked to the people from Ames, and they offered me money to get my house done, and I did. And it added about $15,000 to the value of my house. When I got this loan, before I got the loan with Ames, my interest rate was like 7.5%, and I was paying $658 a month. When they gave me the loan, it was a little more. It was 7.75%, and my payments went up to 7.25%, but I felt, well, I'll probably be able to afford this. You know where we did my closing? We did my closing in my car in a parking lot because it was the weekend, and he was in a hurry. It was coming up to a holiday. It was about 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon, and he says, we have to get it done before the end of the month, otherwise it won't go through. In the process of signing these papers in the parking lot in my car, he said something about an adjustable rate mortgage, but he said, don't worry about it. You know, at the end of 2 years, your rates and your payments may change, but you don't have to worry about it. We're here for you. As a matter of fact, your interest rate will probably go down and your payments will probably go down. And I thought, wow, I would be stupid if I don't go ahead and take advantage of this. I just got to do this. And because I am on a limited income, every penny counts for me. So I went ahead and signed these papers. In about 45 days, they sold my mortgage to another company. And at the end of 2 years, I started getting letters about your interest rate is going to change and your payments are going to go up. Well, at that time, I was no longer working full-time. I'm only working part-time now, and I'm on a pension. And so at the end of 2 years, my interest rate started at 9.5%. It's an adjustable rate, and my payments went up to 8.50. In about 60 days, I got another letter saying it's going to go up to 11%, and then my payments went up to 1,100. And then I got another letter saying, another 60 days, that it's going up to 1,300. Well, I didn't have the money. I didn't have the money, and so I quit paying, and my house went into foreclosure.
I have to interrupt because of the time problem. Could you finish maybe with a brief summary?
Summary is that my house is all that I have. When my child gets ready for college, I'm going to have to sell my house and use that money to send him to college. So I have to keep my house. Acorn was able to get my loan modified, and I am now in my house. I now have a fixed mortgage. But the other thing I want to say is that, you know, a society's greatness can only be judged by the way it treats its elderly and its young. And our elderly are being preyed upon. They're being victimized. Please help us. Thank you
very much for your testimony, Ms. Davis. Mr. Kiva, and then Mr. Leto, and Mr. Crump.
Okay, my name is Ed Kibble.
Welcome, and thank you for introducing yourself. And for the record, if you continue with your testimony, please.
Okay, I think everybody recognizes that predatory lending is a very big problem. That's not why I'm testifying today. I'm here to testify about how difficult it is to try to stand up against predatory lending. We tried and we're shocked with the outcome. We were going to refinance our house back 3 years ago in 2004 when the interest rates were at their bottom. We were put in contact with Wellspring Mortgage. They promised us a rate about an eighth of a point better than we were able to find elsewhere, so we went ahead. It became very, very clear that something was wrong when we discovered that our loan had been increased by $4,500 over and above what we had signed on for. So we asked the broker to return the loan to the original amounts, as we did not want to fall prey to a bait-and-switch mortgage scam consisting of adding $4,500 in undisclosed fees. What followed was nothing less than shocking. It became very clear to us that the broker never had any intention of honoring the original terms. We were told that our property had very low collateral value because we had hazardous materials in our soil and septic system, and that we were being declined by the lender. I'm not kidding. We pursued the issue with Minnesota Department of Health. They sent a letter. One of the statements of the letter is, there is no evidence or even any reason to suspect the soil at 13888 44th Street North contains any hazardous materials. The broker continued to take the position, even having this letter in hand, that we had been declined by the lender. The statement said, loan is declined due to negative environmental conditions indicated on the appraisal. We asked for a copy of the appraisal. We sent an email, certified letter, and fax requesting a copy of this appraisal indicating that we had poor collateral value and the appraisal from which our loan decline was based. We were told that a copy of this appraisal could not be produced because it didn't exist. We were shocked. Why did we think that the broker asked the lender to decline us and then later asked the lender not to allow an appraisal to be conducted? Because we've got extensive documentation to prove it. Since the broker was repeatedly unwilling to honor the contractual agreement, we were ready to take action. We had the facts on our side, we had the laws on our side, we had the government consumer protection agency on our side. But unfortunately, we were very naive about how things worked. We handed the investigation over to, along with documents like the one I was referencing, on silver platter to the Commerce Department. They told her this broker was one of the worst in the state. Our complaint is approaching three-year birthday, and to the best of our knowledge, no action has been taken. We filed a lawsuit in federal court against the broker. The defense strategy of this broker was they effectively argued that Minnesota statutes had no teeth, that the broker had no fiduciary responsibility, that no damages could be collected for any of the Minnesota statute violations because the actions by the broker did not allow a private right of action. And the same thing is true for collecting reasonable attorney fees. In other words, they're saying that this had nothing to do with the facts, that the current laws prevented us from collecting damages from them. We thought this was a ridiculous and outrageous position. In the end, they were right, we were wrong. This had nothing to do with the extensive and irrefutable evidence. We could not get relief in court because private right of action was limited for violation of broker duties under state law. What did this tell us? It told us that a consumer in Minnesota does not have any practical legal recourse against predatory lending practices. We firmly believe that the current laws, enforcement of these laws, and consequences of violating these laws are not acting as a deterrent against predatory lending, but in fact may be actually encouraging it. This is not about a bait-and-switch predatory lending scam. It's not about falsifying underwriting documentation. It's much bigger than that. This is about an environment that encourages and rewards unscrupulous conduct. This is quite a business model, placing one-sided bets and never having to worry about losing. The more you bet, the more you make. As private individuals, we've invested about 3 years of our life in an excess of $20,000 trying to stand up against predatory lenders. As you can see, it's clear we need your help. Please, people are losing their houses because of this. It's not right. That's why I'm here. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Kugel, for your testimony. Mr. Lettel, and would you welcome to come first, and you state your name, and then proceed with your testimony. We are running a little tight on time.
Absolutely, Mr. Chair. Brad Lepto, Legislative Director for the Minnesota AFL-CIO, and I'll be very brief. I just did want to get on the record our support for the legislation. We thank Representative Clark, Representative Dabney, Representative Mullery for their efforts in this area. I just want to say that our support did generate from the grassroots on this, starting in 2002. Various central labor councils around the state were hearing about this from union members and non-union members alike. In 2000, I know Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Duluth City Councils heard testimony. The Central Labor Councils were involved in 2003. We had a resolution at our state convention in support of this types of legislation, and then in 2004 again, and reauthorized in 2006. And that was by over 600-plus delegates unanimously approved that. The only final thing I'd like to mention is that I know that, because the testimony here has been so eloquent, I cannot add anything to that, quite honestly, except the fact that it was mentioned that this type of practice destabilizes neighborhoods. I would add that it adds to the destabilization of the middle class, is what this really, you know, and I think we've had that in a number of other areas, but I think in this area it certainly does do that as well. And I thank you for your time.
Thank you very much for your efficient testimony. Is Mr. Crump present? Welcome to the committee, Mr. Crump, and if you give your name for the record and proceed with your testimony, testimony, hopefully.
Yes. I'm Jeff Crump. I'm an associate professor of housing studies at the University of Minnesota. Thank you for having me here today. I've been researching the issue of subprime predatory lending in Twin Cities for the last 4 years, and basically I've found what every other study in every other city in the United States has found, that subprime lending is basically the probability of getting subprime loans is greatly increased if you're a part of a minority, and that the rate of foreclosures is skyrocketing in many parts of our metropolitan area, in many ways reversing 20 years of strenuous community development efforts. I just want to briefly comment on one of the issues connected with this sort of legislation, which is what will it do to the flow of credit into low-income communities. And I'm just going to briefly quote from a study that was assessed the impact of the North Carolina predatory lending law, which was published in Housing Policy Debate, which is a journal which is published by the Fannie Mae Foundation. And I'll just briefly quote, "We can reasonably conclude that access to subprime credit for home buyers was not limited by the implementation of the North Carolina Act. And further, we have demonstrated that a carefully crafted law can selectively filter out the most egregious kinds of subprime loans without having to resort to punitive enforcement provisions that increase the cost of securitization." Basically, what they found through an exhaustive analysis of very good data, which was that the North Carolina predatory lending law works. It limits the number of predatory loans and does not cut off the flow of credit to low-income buyers. Thank you for hearing me.
Thank you very much for that efficient testimony, Mr. Crump. We'll now move. Are there any others who wish to testify in favor of the bill? Seeing none, we'll now move to testifiers in opposition. We have 20 minutes. I also want to indicate we have 16 testifiers on my list. That means we're going to have to be very, very, very efficient. I will cut off testimony after 20 minutes. So as you speak, please keep in mind that you may be taking time from some other testifiers. So welcome to the committee, and if you'll state your name for the record and proceed quickly with your testimony, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Joe Witt. I'm the CEO of the Minnesota Bankers Association. The MBA represents 96% of the commercial banks in the state of Minnesota, from the smallest to the largest. And just a point of clarification, I am not here speaking in opposition to the bill. I know that was the way the testifiers were laid out on the schedule, but I am not here to speak in opposition to the bill. We have a keen interest in this topic. Predatory lending makes all lenders look bad. A lot of times when you hear a news report on this, it'll start off by saying the banks did a certain predatory practice, when in actuality it's generally not the banks that are the problem that we're looking to get at here. I appreciate the Attorney General's task force work. They put together an excellent report studying the data, the different practices that are out there. I also appreciate that bankers were represented on that task force. We had a couple members of our association that were represented on that task force. We appreciate that. We also appreciate the notation in the report that specifically says that the banks are not the problem. There's lots of different lenders in the community, and we really appreciate that banks were singled out as not contributing to this problem. We have had lots of discussion with the interested parties on the particular bills that are in front of us, on the Dabney bill, the Clark bill, as well as the Mullery bill. Appreciate the opportunity to put our input with the interested parties as well as the authors. Our goal is to craft the best bill possible to get at these problems, and we really think that we're in a good position to add to this process, because as the legitimate lenders that are out there, we really are able to help define what the legitimate practices are so that we can hone in more closely on what the problems are that we want to get at. Our role is not to create some concessions from the authors. Our role really is to help get at the problems without harming the legitimate transactions that are out there. Like the last testifier said, when you look at different lending laws around the country, there are some that have worked out very well, that have gotten at the problems without restricting the flow of credit. We want to make sure that anything that comes out of Minnesota is consistent with that model. I want to thank, again, the authors for working with us, appreciate the opportunity to be heard here today.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Before we go on the list, if Mr. Swalen is present, we might ask him to make a comment. He's with the Federal Credit Union Highway. He may have testimony similar to yours, and it might be useful for both of you to do it at the same time.
Did you want me now, Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Okay.
If you're Jeff.
I am.
Welcome to the committee, and if you'll state your name for the record, please, and proceed with a brief testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and the committee. My name is Jeff Schwallen, and I'm here representing the 167 credit unions in the state of Minnesota. I am president of Highway Federal Credit Union. We're just up the road at Ryson, Pennsylvania, and I'd like to say for the record, we bring you the surcharge-free ATM located over in the MnDOT building.
We're all very grateful. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Credit unions in Minnesota are in favor of the regulation or the proposed law. We as lenders are three types of lenders in Minnesota. We either hold on to our loans, we're asset-based lenders, real estate loans, or we use a third-party provider in a marketing agreement, or we also sell into the secondary market as most of the major players here. I have been on the board of directors for the Mortgage Association of Minnesota. I've also been on the board of directors over my past 30 years as in the real estate area for the Minneapolis Builders Association. So I've actively been in the industry. We think that it is most appropriate that there should be no prepayment penalty, so we support that. There should be no negative amortization, and we should be verifying the income and cash available or savings available for housing. And we as credit unions typically underwrite locally, as do most of the players in the state of Minnesota. We would like the committee again to offer legislation that has no prepayment penalty. We also believe there should be a minimum net worth requirement. I know that's part of possibly another bill that may be introduced. We would see that as those people are around and they tend to self-police themselves. If you have a substantial or at least a minimum net worth, you tend to want to be a player and you want to be good with the members or the customers that you're dealing with, and you would tend to be in business for a longer period of time. We support educational criteria, and we certainly support the idea of that there should be no churning in the provision. We do support the Representative Dabney's amendment to House File 1004, and we believe that the bona fide companies throughout here, and I have friends in the audience, are doing the right thing. And we as credit unions believe that we are doing the right thing and strongly support the proposed legislation. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Mr. Witt and Mr. Swalen were placed on the testimony in opposition, and clearly they're not. So I want to thank you for your testimony and let the committee know and testifiers that we will have the 20 minutes for those in opposition. So I didn't want to take credit from the second group. So if Mr. Lowe would come forward, and Mr. Andrzejewski, followed by Quason, Chen, Sanchez.
Hi, I'm Curtis Lowe. I'm not testifying in opposition to the bill, just more in commentary. My last name is spelled L-O-E-W-E. I'm a mortgage originator, senior mortgage originator with Minnesota Lending Company. And before I did that as an occupation, I had the privilege of working in the Office of the Attorney General and managing consumer services from 1983 through early 1999. It was involved very much in legislative work dealing in mortgage lending laws back in the mid-90s and the late 90s, and the Mortgage Originators Licensing Act, laws dealing with private mortgage insurance, interest on escrows, etc. And one of the main things of as you look back at those laws is that the goal of the legislature and of all the people involved in it was to make sure that we had a defined laws that we knew where the roadmap was, that they were objective, and people could understand where the stop sign is and where it starts and where it stops. And I would hope that whatever comes out of this legislative effort, I applaud the work of the Attorney General, applaud the work of the Commerce Department in its recent regulatory actions, is that we have a roadmap, that it's defined, that we know where to start and stop, and that there has to be a balance. I'm a mortgage loan originator, and it is very complex, and sometimes I wish, and this is from my days of being a consumer advocate, I really wish that the mortgage loan documents could be written in plain language. I look at the Plain Language Contract Act, and I wish, gee, why couldn't, because we've all gone to closings. In the end, I want to briefly tell a story about a closing that took place yesterday. A loan that was done for an emerging market couple that was first 10 years of their loan would be interest only, and the last 20 years would be on an amortized basis. They worked very hard to have their credit scores improved. They worked very hard to make sure they had the dream of home ownership. And that loan closed because of those kind of loan products. So there is a delicate balance that I think we have to reach in this legislation as we look towards those loan products.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Mr. Androsky?
Thank you.
Can you give me your name for the
yes, sir.
Record, thank please, and then proceed.
I want to thank the committee. My name is Chris Andruski, and I'm the owner of Minnesota Financial Solutions. We've been in business for about 10 years. I'm a licensed CPA in the state of Minnesota. I have an MBA and am involved pretty extensively with the Southern Association of Realtors as I teach real estate taxation law, finance classes, etc., to realtors. And as a CPA, the biggest problem that I've observed in this industry is the lack of barrier to entry when it comes to testing, education for the people providing these products, etc. The Department of Commerce has suggested some network requirements, which I as an owner, can meet. But I don't think it's the state's role to set an arbitrary barrier to entry when you're entering a business, because I wouldn't have been able to start my business 10 years ago had that barrier been there. It should be based on skill, education, etc. I think education is so important in this industry, because we've already had some testimony that's suggested how material this purchase is for all the families in Minnesota. I also want to also just remind the committee that some of the no documentation or stated programs aren't subprime loans. I mean, there's a lot of good borrowers where banks will lend money to them all day long. I have a friend from grad school. He's a self-made millionaire. I just did a cash-out refi on his loan. We borrowed to 65% of a rental property he owned outright. He paid cash for a vacation home in Reno. He has a 780 credit score. That's a good loan. Every bank will fund that money. He's got $2 million in the bank. These aren't all subprime loans. I wholeheartedly believe that we need to stop the subprime predatory lending, but we also need to realize these aren't all subprime loans, these reduced documentation loans. These are good people that have built equity. They're entrepreneurs. Maybe they are having a down year because they sold their business 5 years ago, which is the case in this particular gentleman's case. We need to stop the misleading advertising. It drives me nuts when I get a fax that says 1.9% for 5 years. When we get calls at home where people are saying, lower your payment to $800 a month. Realtors are advertising a house that they're listing with a fictitious payment
that doesn't include interest or principal, excuse me, that doesn't include taxes, insurance, et cetera. So I think we need to examine this. We need to stop the predatory lending. We need to be smart about protecting small business and brokers. And federally chartered banks should not be able to offer these products without the brokers offering them also, because that's a violation of antitrust, and it creates monopolies, and ultimately the consumer will pay more.
Thank you very much for your testimony. You're right
on
time. Ms. Clayson. Would you state your name? Welcome to the committee, first of all, and then would you state your name for the record and then proceed quickly with your testimony?
Yep. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Lisa Marie Sanchez, so I'd like to speak first, if I can. I am co-founder of Brokers and Banking School of America. Our school specializes in mortgage education. We have made a commitment to our industry, our schools, our communities to support legislation that decreases predators in lending. As we've all heard here, there is a serious problem in Minnesota. Our industry supports a zero-fraud tolerance policy. I want to begin by stating that we are not against this bill. In fact, there are many parts of this bill that we do support. We feel that this committee is right on track, but we feel that we need to acknowledge and define the areas that are going to be impacted the hardest based on statistics of other states that have passed similar legislation. I believe that if we do not amend this bill with objective measurements, these new regulations are going to end up hurting the very people that we are supposed to be designed to protect by making it more difficult for borrowers to qualify. One example, quickly, is suitability. I'm completely for suitability if standard is designed correctly. We have to define the standard specifically so that there will be no guessing on the broker's part. A larger example would be, as a broker, a couple would ask for my assistance in obtaining a mortgage. During the interview loan process, I was told by the couple that both of them work full-time. After the loan approval process was completed and my client chose a product that best suited their needs, we set the loan to close. At the closing, the wife mentions to me how excited she is to purchase the home before she has a baby. She also happens to mention that she's currently trying to get pregnant with their first child. Under this proposed suitability clause, I, as the broker, am left with determining whether I should close this loan or not, because at the time of the initial loan interview and during the loan approval process, I was not told by the wife of their intentions to expand their family. Due to the disclosure, I would have to reconsider if they are still suitable for this loan based on the information that I had just received. Under the new proposed bill, I, as the broker, have the responsibility to determine the definition of suitability, and that definition may differ from yours, the judges, the lawyers, the attorney general, the lenders, etc.
Thank you, ma'am. I'm sorry I have to cut your testimony at this point. Ms. Clayson?
Mr. Chairman and many and members of the committee, my name is Kim Clayson. I am also a co-founder of Brokers and Banking School of America. I am a minority mortgage broker and have continuously been working in the mortgage industry for more than 10 years. When forming the school, Lisa Murray and I made it a priority to ensure that all curriculum taught within will reinforce our industry's no-tolerance for fraud policy. We have heard many heartfelt testimonies today. I have helped many who have been affected by such predatory tactics. I am not against any bill that will protect consumers from such predatory tactics, but I am against legislation that will prevent or decrease housing opportunities in the minority or low-income communities. The way this bill has been presented before this committee will have that effect. I would like to thank all parties who have made it a priority to get predators out of our business. This would include the Attorney General Lori Swanson and all other parties invited to assist with this very difficult task. I would also like to address the following issues that have a direct impact on the minority and low-income communities. The first issue is the 5% cap on all fees. The proposed bill before this committee recommends that the current Minnesota state law that mandates mortgage broker fees be modified to include third-party uncontrollable fees. If this proposed modification passes, this will add an unwanted burden to the minority and low-income communities. This underserved market will have challenging will have a challenging time finding products and loan professionals to help them in their effort to secure a mortgage. It takes the same amount of effort and dollars for a mortgage professional to approve a $50,000 loan as it would a $250,000 loan. This new fee requirement will lead many mortgage professionals to involuntarily exiting this underserved community due to circumstances not in their control.
Ms. Grayson, I have to cut your testimony. I'm very, very sorry. I would like to suggest to testifiers and for those who have more to say that if they might want to put their further testimony in writing, we'd be more than happy to accept that and distribute it to the committee for the proposal.
Thank you.
Thank you. Sorry again. Mr. Hotstead and Mr. Rafferty.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, and thank you to the rest of the committee. My name is Mark Hotstead. I'm an independent mortgage broker in Faribault, Minnesota, Hawthorne Mortgage Corporation. I'm here not opposing House File 1004 as well. I am, however, concerned about some of the provisions. My own personal experience, several years ago, I refinanced my home into a 20-year fixed-rate mortgage. After that, my wife was diagnosed with lupus. And, we came into thousands and thousands of dollars of insurmountable non-covered medical bills. My wife went through chemotherapy for 9 months due to her kidneys shutting down, and that didn't work. We went to Rochester Mayo and were told that we could use a experimental treatment that would cost us out of our pocket due to our insurance company, which we have an excellent insurance company, would not cover because of its experimental use. That treatment was 95% successful, and she is now in remission, but we have to curtail a lot of the activities that we do because of it. Due to the unsurmountable medical bills, I was forced to refinance. This was within an 18-month period. My interest rate was higher, but due to a lot of the medical collections that were numbering in the thousands of dollars that had gone against my credit, we couldn't get a conforming loan. However, my wife's credit was still good, so we used her self-employed income as a stated income. We did an interest-only loan to curtail our expenses, our monthly expenses. It was a five-year ARM interest-only stated income product. We were able to pay off thousands of dollars of medical bills that we would have not been able to do if that option was not to us, that loan of the option was not available to us. The alternative would be either file bankruptcy or liquidate our children's educational plans and take a penalty on those. The next thing that I was able to do with some of the extra cash out that I was able to take out on a later loan that was also utilized as an income, a stated income loan, I was able to purchase two very dilapidated rundown buildings in my rural community of Faribault, Minnesota. They were historic. They were vacant. I have now, in turn, redeveloped those, and I am myself, I'm a tenant in one, and in the building next door, I have a thriving new retail commercial entity that is bringing commerce into downtown Faribault. In closing, these loans are available to people that may be having economic strife, credit strife, but these stated income loans and ARM loans are good tools for not only myself, but for rural Minnesotans that can not get into a loan without a lower payment or maybe an expanded type loan of a product that requires only stated income or no income verification.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hofstede.
Difficult for me.
Thank you for your testimony. Mr. Rafferty, before you start, we still have a number of testifiers. I'm wondering if those of you who are finished, if there are some of you who might be willing to allow one of the other testifiers basically to present your arguments so that we could reduce the time. And I feel bad about cutting the time so tightly with all of you, but there were so many testifiers in a limited time. I haven't any choice. So anyway, Mr. Rafferty, welcome to the committee, and if you'll state your name for the record, please, and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Keenan Rafferty, and I want to be on record as not speaking in opposition to the bill. I work as Vice President of Community Development at Homestead Mortgage. I vice chair the Emerging Markets Home Ownership Initiative. I'm the chairperson of the Affordable Housing Committee for the Mortgage Association of Minnesota. I'm an advisory board member for the Minnesota Home Ownership Center and serve on the board of directors for a national nonprofit called Lenders Who Care. But for the record, I'm here today specifically and solely representing the Mortgage Bankers Association of Minnesota, where I serve as president. Every day I have the opportunity to talk with folks who provide housing opportunities for Minnesotans, and I'm convinced that the overwhelmingly vast majority of the industry is working to do what is right, just, ethical, and professional for the Minnesotans we serve. I'm also very aware that my industry is steaming mad. We are mad that a few bad apples, true greedy scoundrels and criminals, are tarnishing the image and reputation of our entire industry. For my members and myself, we are disgusted at the headlines we read, and we want to work with you to do what is right for Minnesotans. We want to be perfectly clear that our industry is in full support of measures that will heighten enforcement and root out the bad guys. We do not want them in our industry, in our neighborhoods, or in Minnesota. Our industry also agrees with proposed legislation that we should only be doing loans that are suitable for our clients. This only makes sense. Yet, it is not enough to describe suitability in vague terms. That can only be decided on after a loan is closed, or worse yet, after a loan has gone bad. At that point, it's too late. What we are asking for is a front-end objective standard that our industry could use as a pre-closing test to make sure that there is a real, net, tangible benefit to each Minnesotan that pursues a loan. A suitable loan should be able to demonstrate a net, tangible benefit to the consumer. If it doesn't, it should be declined prior to funding, and our consumers will thank us for that. Think of it. If our entire industry was held to the same detailed objective standard, we could implement a consumer protection test prior to a loan ever being approved or funded. And that would ensure that every loan has a real net tangible benefit to the consumer. As president of the Mortgage Bankers Association of Minnesota, and in closing, the Mortgage Association of Minnesota, I want to officially offer our support and cooperation in crafting this language and helping assure that a front-end objective suitability standard can be met. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Mr. Rafferty. If there are other testifiers who are either neutral or speaking in favor of the bill, would you not testify at this time? We want to say reserve what's left for those in opposition.
Chair. Yep. I had a question for Mr. Rafferty, and just a quick one.
Mr. Rafferty.
You say you support standards, putting them in law so that everybody's playing on the same level playing field. Do you have an idea of standards? Do you have those you could bring forward, give to the authors of the bill that we could incorporate in the bill to meet the standard that you want, that so that this would actually do what you claim it would do and help and make the bill better?
Thank you. Yes, we'd be very anxious to cooperate in crafting that. We have a very diverse delivery system in Minnesota and across our country. Loans come from a variety of different places. What this would allow us to do is hold everyone to the same standard. Right now, individual shops might have their own standards. This would allow us to really set that in statute and to help everyone work by the same playing field, really for the protection of the Minnesota consumers.
Thank you, Mr. Rafferty.
So if you have those, could you please bring those forward for Representative Dabney, Representative Mullery, Representative Clark, so that they can incorporate them in their bill? I'm sure everybody would be like to see those. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Rafferty. Dr. Kleiner and Ms. Amaya. Welcome to the committee. If you would state your name for the record, please, and proceed quickly with your testimony.
My name is...
We are getting short on the 20 minutes.
All right. Mr. Chairman, I'm Dolly Amaya, and for the record, my name is spelled Dolly Amaya, owner of Real Financing and Investment. I'm originally from Colombia. I came to the United States with an honest dream to own a piece of land. The dream did not stop there. I went to Harvard and later became a business owner. All of those dreams have been obtainable by working 3 jobs for 14 consecutive years, loan hours, and by saving in real estate equity. as a foreigner with no traditional credit, being a first-time home buyer and needing 100% financing, I purchased my home through an emerging market program. Later, I refinanced under an ARM product and cashed out the equity to open my own business. None of this would have been possible if the legislation being proposed today was in place back in those years. As a broker, I have helped many minority families obtain their dreams of becoming home and business owners. These successful entrepreneurs generate great revenue and thousands of dollars to Minnesota's economy. My case is not isolated. 95% of my customers base are minority with lack of credit history, no long-term employment, or no down payment at hand. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, state programs, emerging markets, and ARM programs are absolutely essential to preserve the American dream of home ownership for minorities and even like Caucasian families. It is a sincere wish that the bill does not kill the attempt to address what we failed to monitor in years past. Brokers and originators who abuse the programs deserve to be reprehended, but to abolish the one tool brokers have to assist this underserved borrowers is not the answer. We must ask to remain responsible but realistic.
Thank you for allowing me to speak. Terrific timing. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Mr. Steelbread, is that how you pronounce your name?
Morris Kleiner.
Oh, Kleiner. Okay, I'm sorry.
Chairman,
I'm
and
wishing to move forward, I guess. Thank you. Would you state your name again? And then,
Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Morris Kleiner, and I'm a professor of public affairs and industrial relations at the Humphrey Institute at the University of Minnesota. I'm not speaking in opposition to the bill, and my opinions and comments no way reflect any of the positions of the university. I'm here to provide background for the potential bill in terms of regulation of mortgage brokers. 30 years ago, there were few mortgage brokers in the U.S. and Minnesota, but last year, more than 60% of housing finance involved mortgage brokers. There's developed a tension between the large increase in home ownership, which stood at almost 70% in 2006, which was up from about 65% in 1996, and the growth in the number of foreclosures, which some estimate around 20% of the subprime or risky loans. The case for regulation is that home mortgages are a large financial transaction that's complicated. Consumers may be at a disadvantage relative to an experienced or even unscrupulous broker. A goal of the government is to provide clear and unambiguous information to consumers with respect to prices they're being charged and the level of risk they're undertaking. Any attempt by banks or mortgage brokers to raise the price of the loan beyond an agreed-upon price can be grounds for fraud or criminal penalties. Fewer regulations with bonding requirements that account for fiduciary responsibilities and higher penalties would allow consumers a greater share of the American dream. Creating too many regulations would drive up price with uncertain impacts on the quality of the loan. Recent analysis of Wisconsin and Minnesota, which was less regulated, showed little impact on measures of foreclosure with more regulations, but it potentially reduced minorities, such as members of the Hmong community, who've been successful at increasing home ownership for their community and the opportunity of obtaining home financing. As the committee contemplates the level of regulation, you need to consider the tension between the protection from bad apples who inhabit any occupation and the ability of potential homeowners to get reasonably priced loans that fit their current and prospective lifestyles.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Again, if there are testifiers speaking in favor of the bill, please do not testify at this time. Mr. Skilbrand? Would you welcome to the committee, and if you'll state your name and briefly give your testimony. We may have to ask the rest of the testifiers to provide testimony in writing, I'm afraid.
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Skilbred, and Mr. Spencer.
Mr. Chairman and members, David Skilbred, Vice President of Government Relations for the Independent Community Bankers of Minnesota, a statewide association of 300 privately held community-focused banks. Mr. Chairman and members, we've been following this bill. We've had concerns about it. We've been working with those parties, such as the Attorney General's office. We appreciate that. There is a member of our banking association on the study group. We appreciate that. We've met with Ms. Hawkins and Mr. Elwood from Legal Aid, and we'll continue to do that. We believe that predatory lending is inconsistent with the culture of independent banking. We want to help people succeed and not fail. We want informed borrowers who know what they're getting into so that they can do that. As we work forward, we hope that we would get a bill that achieves something where it does not eliminate good products that good people need to advance their lives, that we have clear objective standards that everyone can agree to and know what they're getting into, and that the results, therefore, attack the issue of predatory lending and don't go beyond into the general commercial market. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for that brief testimony, and I appreciate it. The last testifier for the present will be Mr. Eldon Spencer. Welcome to the committee, and if you'll state your name for the record and proceed.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll try to be concise. My name is Eldon Spencer. I'm a private attorney in Minneapolis and also the legal counsel for the Minnesota Association of Mortgage Brokers. I'd like to focus in the spirit of the chair on things that haven't been said, and so I'd like to focus on the fourth section of your bill, Mr. Chair, relating to fiduciary duties, which is one of those concepts that really sounds good, but when you look at it in detail, it really is inappropriate. In fact, I would argue it's both inappropriate and unnecessary for this industry. I took a look at Black's Law Dictionary, which is what those who studied law kind of start with, and even Black's Law Dictionary has a difficult time because of the hundreds of years that common law built up around this concept. You know, it's applied in guardianships, it's applied in trust relationships, but they point out that it's an inherently broad term. It requires a duty to act primarily for another, and it also gives rise to an innate conservatism. And I'd like to just point out why that isn't a good thing here. As far as the inherently broad term, this has kind of gotten at a little bit by Representative Nelson's question to Mr. Raverty. You know, concepts are great, but let's have a specific list. Let's try to help, like in Mr. Kibble's testimony, address those situations that are bad, and yet not throw out a concept when we aren't really sure how it applies in this kind of situation. I mean, does Terry Ryan care about the players? Of course. Should he be a fiduciary for the Twins players? No, because he's an employee of the Minnesota Twins. Similarly, employees of mortgage brokers have a duty of loyalty to their employer, so it's not appropriate. What is appropriate, I'd submit, Mr. Chair and others, is the approach that you and Representative Mullery in your bill have taken to list specific practices that ought to be prohibited. It sounds like you're looking forward to moving forward, so I'll simply say that the innate conservatism is another problem with this. There, as some of the other witnesses have testified, there's a role for ARMs. ARMs were put in because in the 1980s, those of us who go back far enough, I guess, as the chair and I, you know, the lenders needed to protect themselves. But if you have to focus in each case to get a suitable bill on saying, will that borrower be able to pay the maximum thing, rate that could possibly happen, that itself, again, you know, isn't necessarily appropriate for all borrowers. With that, I'll stop my testimony because I know the chair needs
Thank
to.
Thank you, Mr. Spencer. I would mention one thing. When I had my realtor's license, I had a clear understanding of what my fiduciary responsibility was to the sellers.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're
right. We haven't time here, but I would like at some time to hear from you why a broker would not have a fiduciary responsibility to those who are seeking funding for a purchase.
Mr. Chair, I'm delighted to meet with you. I'm bothered. I'd analogize it more to an independent real estate agent, or actually, an independent insurance agent representing a number of lines. But
thank you. Thank you for your testimony. I want to apologize for those who are not able to testify here verbally, but again, I would urge you, if you would, to supply a written testimony for the committee. I would like to call back Representative Dabney to move his bill, House File 1004, for recommendation for pass, and to be referred to the Committee of Commerce and Labor. Do you so?
I do so move, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that. I also would like to move the AO70160 amendment that has been referred to by several of the testifiers.
The Representative Dabney has moved A070160 to be added as an amendment. Any discussion? Yes, Mr. Szymanski.
Thank you, Mr.
Representative Szymanski, please, excuse me.
I would like to consider tabling this bill at this time to incorporate the some more of the language that Mr. Raverty had indicated he thinks would improve the bill. And I would just ask for that consideration.
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Szymanski, I believe we're on the amendment right now.
Mr. Chair, there is a motion on the floor
yes.
at this time.
That's right. Any questions about the amendment? Hearing none, all those in favor of the adding the amendment to the bill, main bill, indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just like to briefly respond to some of the testimony from opponents and others who have commented on the bill. First of all, there's been some testimony that we are banning adjustable rate mortgages. This bill does not ban adjustable rate mortgages. There have been indications or testimony that we are banning stated income or no documentation loans. This bill does not ban stated income or no documentation loans. There's been testimony that we may be abolishing the subprime loans and subprime lending market here in Minnesota, or loans to people with blemished credit histories. We are not banning subprime loans, the industry, or subprime loans to people with blemished credit histories. What we are doing is ensuring that when consumers are sold a mortgage, they can afford to pay for that mortgage, and that that mortgage is appropriate for them. There's been testimony that there is a suitability requirement in this bill. There is no suitability requirement in this bill. What there is a requirement that the mortgage sold be affordable to the borrower. With that, Mr. Chair, I'd ask for member support.
Thank you. Representative Dabney, do you also have an oral amendment?
I believe we'll hold the oral amendment until the next committee if the bill does indeed progress. It's primarily a remedying a small oversight.
Thank you. Any discussion on the bill at this point? Hearing none, Representative Dabney?
Yes.
Representative Anderson?
A couple of comments. It's been a great day of different testimony from the different parties that have been involved in this. I've been very pleased with everyone's understanding that this issue needs to be addressed, predatory lending overall. And I think that what Representative Szymanski raised as an issue of concern that we need to look at the front end of things, and I hope that Representatives Mullery and Dabney and Clark do look at those issues of the training component, of the making sure that we have standards. We had some great folks that testified, Ms. Quason and Ms. Sanchez-Ledens, about that issue as well. But I also think that we need to take some time, too, and I hope that you do before it moves on to the next committee to address the issue of the arm, though I know that you have said that you're not specifically, it doesn't say right in the language that you're banning the arm. I think it would be helpful to talk to the different industry people that are involved in the industry to see what the ramifications will be and the implications of this for folks in trying to access some of this. Also looking at the 5% cap, I'm concerned in hearing the testimony from Ms. Davis whether under this new language, if she would have been able to receive a home improvement loan with the 5% cap in place. And I think it would be helpful to speak. I think it was Ms. Quason that brought up that issue. The other one that I was concerned about is just the suitability and the vagueness of it and what kind of responsibility that we're putting in the hands of mortgage lenders to guess what might impact a person's ability to pay down the road. You're looking at 7 years. Does that mean that as a mortgage broker that you need to look at a person and say if they're in child rearing age bracket that maybe they might have children? Is that something? I think we just need to have a greater clarity on that, and I trust that you guys will take some time to speak with the different parties involved and address those concerns in the future.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Dabney.
Thank you. And Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, thank you for your comments. I can assure you that I've spent a meaningful part of the last several months of my life in conversation with stakeholders 360 degrees on this issue, including members of the mortgage broker industry, banking industry, lending industry, as recently as about 9:30 this morning. I think it was when the last one left my office. But again, I'm highly confident that they know where room 545 is and that those conversations will continue as well. I just would like to reinforce there is not a suitability requirement in this legislation. You spoke to that question of, what if you have a couple who are in those childbearing years in front of you, do you have to take that into account? That speaks to the broad vagueness of a suitability requirement. That is present for people like your stockbroker. It is not proposed in this legislation for your mortgage broker. Your mortgage broker simply has to be able to show that you can afford the mortgage they're trying to sell you.
Representative Anderson? Representative Murray.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Anderson. Just I assure you that I'm also concerned about those. I've been a specialist in real property law for 30 years, more than 30 years now, and I've represented lenders, mortgage brokers, banks, foreclosure companies, everything like that, so I'm very aware of their problems, and I looked at these issues from that perspective, believe me, before authoring the bill.
Thank you, Representative Mullery. Representative Cooper.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And, I think the idea of trying to curb predatory lending is a very noble goal, and I think praise all three of you for trying to do that. I think we got to watch out, however, that we aren't hurting the people that we're trying to help. And I read this little clipping. Governor Blagojevich from Illinois came out and he took their predatory lending bill. And he said this bill is going to be set aside until they can work out certain things. In your mind, are you sure that we are helping people instead of not helping them by this law? Are they going to still have access? Because in Illinois, in various zip codes, 20% fewer home sales by zip code were done because of the law that they had. I don't want to stop and close people out from enjoying the American dream. So I just ask one simple question to all three of the authors, and I again appraise you for doing this because I think it needs to be done. Are you sure that we aren't doing here what they did in Illinois?
Mr. Representative,
stopping people from enjoying the American dream.
Representative Dabney.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to ask Mr. Elwood from Legal Services to come forward. I'm glad to answer your question, Representative Gunther. Mr. Elwood, however, can speak with authority on what the Illinois law was and how it differs from the proposals in any of our bills, and I think we need to start with that factual background first.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. Would you state your name for the record, please, and proceed.
Mr. Chair, Ron Elwood with Legal Aid. Mr. Chair and Representative Gunther, actually it was the Illinois banking regs that were involved, and they were suspended because primarily the counseling requirement there was overbroad, essentially requiring everybody to get counseling before they could get a loan. Representative Mullery's bill has a very, very, very narrowly tailored counseling requirement that would only apply to a special mortgage, which is defined as one of those kinds, the Habitat for Humanity kinds of loans, or the no interest, the forgivable loans. If that kind of a loan is going to be refinanced, then under Representative Mullery's bill, that borrower would have to go back to the original lender, so they have to go back to Habitat or MHFA and seek their counsel to decide whether or not this is a good thing or not. So I think you're really talking about an apples and oranges thing between Illinois and the bill that's being brought forward here in Minnesota.
Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There's a home ownership class is held by an agency in Blue Earth County as well as banks and lending institutions that takes people through the process of developing home ownership. And I think some of those classes that you speak of are certainly a tremendous advantage in giving people the information they would normally not have. So I hope you aren't discouraging things like that, because it does stop a lot of bad things.
Mr. Chair and Representative Gunther, I can only say if you have extra money in your budget this year to fund those folks, we would be grateful. That would be terrific.
If I had a budget, I'd certainly allow you.
I've already asked Representative Gunther for money in the past. But before we go on, further discussion? Representative Shemansky, do you still wish to move your motion to table?
I will withdraw my move.
Thank you very much. Appreciate that. Any other discussion? Hearing no other discussion, Representative Dabney renews his motion that House File 1004 be recommended to pass as amended and re-referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed? Passes. Congratulations.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Mr. Chair and members.
We now need to move on to the Mullery bill.
I'll move Representative Mullery's bill.
Thank you very much, Representative Nelson. Representative Mullery's bill, House File 931, is to be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. Any discussion?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir.
Would you please ask the audience to hold down the noise? I believe members of the committee are having trouble hearing, and out of respect to Representative Mullery.
I lost control of my class, Mr. Dabney, please excuse me. All right. Would those in the audience please carry on their discussions outside? We still have work to do here. Representative Mullery, would you wish to make a comment?
Well, just really brief. As I said, I've looked at this from both the perspective of having represented people in the industry and also what's happening in my district, which is the hardest hit in the state by far from the fact of these predatory loans. And I believe we definitely need this, and I think the bill is a suitable way to get at it. And as you heard, the North Carolina model, which isn't too far from ours, has been very effective without causing problems.
Thank you very much. Any discussion on this bill? Representative Nelson.
Mr. Chair and members, I think what we need to do here, these bills are a step in the right direction. Hopefully that both authors, all three authors, will continue to work with the mortgage brokers to try and get the language that they claim that they have and that they want to put in here. And because we want to make sure that the dream of home ownership doesn't turn into the nightmare of home ownership. And that's what we're trying to prevent here.
Thank you, Mr. Nelson. Any further discussion? Representative Peterson.
My compliments to you, sir, on showing these people how to run a class as you honed that skill in Edina High School. But I'm still 35 minutes late for my bus.
Well, Representative Peterson, life does not always favor us. But I do want to thank all the members of the committee for their indulgence. Any other discussion? Hearing none, Representative Nelson has moved House File 931 to be recommended for pass and we refer to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Pass. Thank you. Congratulations. Meeting adjourned.